Jacob, in his time, had amassed treasure during his life with Laban the devil in the land of no return. On this day, his darling did so too in the merry land of the dead into which he had died and been sold. For certainly, all that gold exists only in the lower world. Here, in this very spot and space of time, he became a well-to-do man simply by dint of the gold of favor. We know that foreign kings, trading with Pharaoh for gold, were wont to say that in Egypt that metal was no more precious than the dust in the streets. But it is an economic error to think that gold decreases in value the more there is of it. Yes, that was a red-letter day for the snatched-away and set-apart one, a day full of worldly blessing. One could wish that Jacob the father might have beheld it, feeling as he gazed a mixture of pride and dismay in which the first would have outweighed the second. Joseph did wish it, and later he said, "Tell the father of all my glory in Egypt." He had had a letter from Pharaoh that day, not written by the king himself, of course, but by the actual scribe, his secretary, by Pharaoh's order. It was somewhat stiff, but as a calligraphic production, quite delightful, and in its content, most gracious. It said, "Command of the king to Osarsif, the overseer of that which the heavens give, the earth produces, and the Nile brings forth, superintendent of all things in the whole land, and actual administrator of works. My majesty has heard with pleasure the words which a few days before this, in the conversation which the king was pleased to hold with you at On in Lower Egypt, you spoke about heavenly and earthly things. On that happy day, you greatly rejoiced the heart of Neferkeperu-Re with that which he really loves. My majesty heard these words from you with extraordinary pleasure, in that you linked the heavenly with the earthly, and through your concern for the one, at the same time showed great concern for the other, and also contributed to the teaching of my Father who is in heaven. Truly, you know how to say what pleases my majesty extraordinarily, and what you say makes my heart to laugh. My majesty also knows that you rejoice to say what my majesty likes to hear. O Osarsif, I say to you times without end, beloved of his Lord, rewarded of his Lord, favorite and ordained of his Lord. Truly the Lord of Aton loves me, since he has given you to me. As true as Neferkeperu-Re lives eternal, whenever you utter a wish, be it orally or in writing to my majesty will straightway see it granted." And in anticipation of such a wish, in Egyptian thought, the most pressing concern of all, the letter ended by saying that Pharaoh had given orders for the immediate excavation, construction, and decoration of an eternal dwelling. In other words, a tomb for Joseph in the western hills. After the exalted one had read this paper, there took place before the assembled court, in the great columned hall behind the balcony of audience, the great ceremony of the investiture, at which Pharaoh, besides the signet ring already given, and all the gold showered upon him, hung a particularly heavy gold necklace of favor round Joseph's neck, over his immaculate court garment, which of course was not made of silk, as we in our ignorance might think, but of the finest royal linen. The vizier of the south read the letters patent which Pharaoh had conferred, and the style and titles under which henceforth Joseph's death name should be hidden. Most of these we already know from Pharaoh's own lips, and from the formal letter with its official superscription, "Administrator of what the heavens give," and so forth. The most impressive were probably "The King's Shadow Dispenser," "Friend of the Harvest of God," "Nourisher of Egypt," Ka ne keme in the language of the country, "Grand Vizier," although unprecedented, and "Universal Friend of the King," as distinguished from "Unique Friend," sounded pale beside them. But it did not stop there, for Pharaoh was bent on extravagance. Joseph was called Adon of the Royal House, and Adon over all Egypt. He was called Chief Mouthpiece and Prince of Mediation, Increaser of the Teaching, Good Shepherd of the People, Double of the King, Vice Horus. There had not been such a thing before. The future has never repeated it, and probably it could only happen under the dominion of a young king prone to impulsiveness and bursts of extravagant resolve. There was another title still, but that was more like a personal name, and intended not so much to cover as to replace Joseph's own. Posterity has speculated much about it, and even the most respectable tradition gives an inadequate or misleading interpretation. It is said that Pharaoh called Joseph his privy counselor. That is an uninformed version. In our script, the name would have appeared as Jepnut-f-Ankh, which the glib-lipped children of Egypt pronounced Jepnut-f-Ankh, with a palatal ch on the end. The most prominent part of the combination is Ankh, or Ankh, the sign for which, in picture writing, means life, and which the gods held under the noses of men, especially their sons, the kings, that they might have breath. The name, then, which was added to Joseph's many titles, was a name of life. It meant, the god, Aton, one did not need to specify, says, life be with thee. But even that was not its whole meaning. It meant, for every ear that heard it, not only, live thou thyself, but also, be a life-bringer, spread life, give living food to the many. In a word, it was a name that meant satisfaction, sufficiency, and in that character above all had Joseph been exalted. All his titles and styles, insofar as they did not refer to his personal relation to Pharaoh, contained in some form or other this idea of the preservation of life, the feeding of the country, and all of them, including this excellent and much disputed one, could be comprehended in a single epithet, the Provider. The Sunken Treasure. When Jacob's son had had these strings of titles hung around his neck, he was overwhelmed with congratulations. I leave to your imagination the honeyed homage and adulation that followed. Human beings mostly have an itch to accept the arbitrary caprice, the incomprehensible election, the tremendous I favor whom I favor, going beyond all possible calculation, even disarming envy itself, and imparting a kind of sincerity to the words of the veriest toady. Nobody could really understand why Pharaoh was thus exalting this still youthful stranger, but everybody blissfully gave up trying. True, the art of soothsaying was held in honor. It was a partial explanation that Joseph had chanced to distinguish himself in this field and had come off better than the very best domestic product. Moreover, Pharaoh's weakness for those that heard his words was well known. Those, that is, who entered into his theological ideas and realized that interest in them, whether real or assumed, was rewarded by the tenderest gratitude. Here, too, this extraordinary chap both seemed favored by fortune and also apparently had some inherited talent for the sort of thing Pharaoh loved. In any case, it was clear that in dealing with their lord, he had kept his wits about him, with the result that he had been whisked upstairs and now ranked high above them all. They bowed before his successful cunning, no less than before the royal will. They bowed and scraped with a vengeance. They kowtowed and kissed hands for all they were worth. One man among the unique friends of the king, who fancied himself as a writer, had even composed a panegyric in Joseph's honor, and he sang it, accompanied by soft chords on the harp. It went like this. Thou livest, thou art hale, thou art sound. Thou art not poor, thou art not wretched. Thou abidest like the hours. Thy plans abide, thy life is long. Thy speech is choice. Thine eye sees what is good, thou hearest what is pleasing, thou seest good, thou hearest pleasantness. Thou shalt be placed among the counselors, thou standest firm, thy foe falls down, who speaks against thee is no more. Pretty mediocre, but for something written by one of themselves, the court found it capital. Joseph took all this as one whom no preferment surprises, gravely, courteously, though at times, owing to the distraction of his thoughts, the situation verged on the painful, for he was distraught. His mind was not here in Pharaoh's hall. It was in a house of hair on a far hill, or in the grove of the Lord nearby, with his own little brother from the true mother. To that little lad with the helmet-like hair, he was telling his dreams. Or he sat beneath the awning on the harvest field with companions to whom likewise he related his dream. Or at Dothan, in the vale, by a certain well, whither he had come by no gentle means. And thus preoccupied, he almost failed to acknowledge the salutation of a certain courtier to whom such neglect would have been most painful. In other words, among the troop of gratulants was Nefer Emwese, who had once been called just the opposite, the master of the vine. We can feel the fat man's bewilderment and dismay at the tricks life plays as he waited to congratulate, under such undreamed of, such incredibly altered circumstances, his young steward of earlier and evil days. He might hope that the new favorite was friendly disposed and would not speak against him, since to him, Nefer, he owed his summons and his great opportunity. But, on the other hand, the fat man guiltily realized that he had done nothing until the very eve of the prophesying to call attention to Joseph, and then only because the occasion had, so to speak, hit him in the eye. He thought that perhaps Joseph cared as little as himself to be reminded of the prison, so he confined himself to the cautious familiarity of winking one eye, which might mean anything, and had the gratification of seeing Adon wink back. Here and now may be the right time to speak of another possible and how pregnant meeting of old friends, and to justify a silence which has not always been preserved by those who have concerned themselves with Joseph's history. I refer to Potiphar, or Potiphera, more correctly Petipre, the great eunuch, Joseph's former owner, master, and judge, who with such good will threw him into prison. Was he, too, present at the gilding and the reception? And did he, too, pay Joseph homage at court, thus expressing perhaps the respect of a man incapable of a certain thing, but knowing how to value it, for another man who was capable of it, yet also capable of renouncing it? To describe such a meeting is alluring indeed. But alas, nothing of the sort took place. The painfully beautiful motif of reunion plays a triumphant role in our present tale. We shall hear much that is undreamed of, much that is moving on this very theme. But in this place there is only silence, and the silence of our accepted version at this point in the story of the son Chamberlain, and particularly of his honorary wife, the pathetic Mut-Im-Enet, this silence is not simply omission, unless negation can be regarded in that light, the express statement that something did not happen. In other words, that Joseph, after his departure out of the courtier's house, never again met either its master or its mistress. The people, and to please them, the poets, an all-too-easy-going breed, have spun out, in a variety of ways, this tale of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, which was only an episode, if an important one, in the life of Jacob's son. Any possibility of more to follow was, of course, completely excluded by the final catastrophe. But they have written sentimental continuations, and given it a predominant place within the Joseph story. In their hands, it becomes a sugary romance with a proper happy ending. According to these poetasters, the temptress, who goes by the name of Zuleika, a fact at which we can only shrug our shoulders, after she had got Joseph into prison, withdrew, full of remorse, into a hut, and there lived only for the expiation of her sins. Meanwhile, through the death of her husband, she became a widow. But when Yusuf, meaning Joseph, was about to be freed out of the prison, he had refused to have his chains removed until the female aristocracy of the country had come before Pharaoh's throne and borne witness to his innocence. Accordingly, the entire nobility of the sex had come before the king, and with one voice the whole lovely bevy had announced that Joseph was the prince and pattern of purity, the very freshest ornament in her crown. After which Zuleika took the floor and made public confession that she alone had been the offender, and he an angel. The shameful crime was hers, she frankly avowed it, but now she was purified, and gladly bore the shame and disgrace. Even after Joseph's elevation, she continued to do penance, growing old and gray in the process. Only on the festal day, when Father Jacob made his alleged triumphal entry into Egypt, and thus at a time when Joseph was actually the father of two sons, did the pair meet again. Joseph had forgiven the old woman, and as a reward, heaven had restored all her former seductive beauty, whereupon Joseph had most romantically married her, and thus, after all these tribulations, her old wish came true, and they put their heads and feet together.